The 10th Annual Diversity Career Fair and Symposium gets underway on Thursday at Avalon Manor here in Merivale. It's a program that is sponsored by Times Media Company, and we have with us the coordinator of the event this year. She's also the classified advertising manager for the Times, Roxanne Olejnik. Roxanne, thanks for being with us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Take a minute. Tell us what this 10th Annual event is really all about.
We are excited that tomorrow marks a decade of our commitment to diversity and inclusion in our region. So it's a one-day event that focuses on bringing diversity and inclusion to the forefront of Northwest Indiana. It's presented, of course, by the Times Media Company, our In Business magazine, and also Monster.com. It starts with a business symposium first thing in the morning that is geared towards HR professionals and hiring managers. And we're going to have two speakers focusing around two trending diversity topics. We are excited to have Dr. Bridget Harrison, who is the Clinical Director of Innovations and Learning. And she'll be speaking about autism in the workplace, removing barriers and making opportunities. And Aiden Powell, we're excited to have him. He's the program coordinator of the LGBTQ Center at Purdue University. And he's going to be speaking about strategies for improving LGBTQ inclusion at the HR level. Okay. And then in the afternoon, we will host a career fair from noon to 4. It's open to the public, and we're going to feature over 30 different companies from the region. And the Northwest Indiana chapter of SHRM and the Lake County Library will also be offering free resume critiquing during that time of the event. And although this event expands employment opportunities for a diverse region, this event is open to all job seekers of all the demographics.
That's interesting. Very interesting. I guess maybe it seems like it's an obvious point to bring up. I suppose some people may not be aware of it, but how important is it to be able to bring diversity and inclusion to the forefront here in Northwest Indiana?
Well, diversity is just so much more than race and gender. It encompasses ethnic group, encompasses age, personality, physical ability, sexual orientation, education, background, and so much more. People's perceptions can sometimes affect their interactions with others, so this event focuses on how organizations can help their employees embrace our differences and diversity in the workplace.
Has the Times Media Company come up with any kind of idea on who the members of this diverse population might happen to be around here?
Well, I think if you live in Northwest Indiana, we're all members of a diverse population. Diversity is not just how we perceive ourselves, but how we perceive others. And this event will help bring awareness on how there might be some, I guess you would say, misconceived perceptions and how that affects how we interact with each other.
Now, you mentioned the fact that this is going to be an opportunity not only for folks to learn more information if they need a little schooling, but also, too, an opportunity to help you connect diverse community members with businesses, as well as maybe give some job opportunities, because that's what, obviously, the career fair is all about. How about the planning on that end of it? What do you folks have to do to get set up for the Thursday event to be able to accommodate those people?
All the companies that are present at our job fair do embrace diversity and inclusion in their organization, and that is why they participate in this event. NIPSCO has been a supporter for the last 10 years. BP Amoco has always been a part of this. We also have Work One, we have Tredevi, we have Modern Forge Companies, NICSI, JMJ Talent. If you go to nwi.com/diversity, you will see a full list of all the different organizations who are participating. So all of these organizations do embrace diversity and inclusion in their organization, but you will see a lot of these same companies participating and sponsoring this event year after year.
So I guess it's fair to say, too, that if folks come in to attend the event, they can talk with people, obviously, from all of these organizations if they choose. They can also, I guess, apply for jobs as well, too, or at least to get some contacts made there?
Oh, of course. Our vendors will be conducting on-site interviews. Mm-hmm. And we also had people last time leaving our event with a second interview already set up for them.
Wow, that's great. That's great. In the years past here, what kind of input, feedback, and the like that you've gotten from people participating, not only as companies and other people and speakers and like talking about their topics, but people that have been involved in coming and applying for jobs have gotten feedback saying, "Well, I lucked out. I got a nice interview and I got a job out of this here." What kind of information do you get back from people that you've been able to have over the years here that you can make to get this 10th annual event going as well as make it better, maybe even than the last one?
We always, take feedback from our vendors and job seekers, and we've pretty much molded this event around all this feedback that we received throughout the years. Mm-hmm. So we brought in the symposium where we are talking about the trending topics to the HR professionals. And what's nice is it's two events in one day. So the HR professionals are in the morning, they're learning about these topics, but then we're opening it up to the job seekers. And what's nice is we're the only event in this area that focuses on the HR side of it and then also the job seeker element and really just embracing our region and all the diverse aspects that we are made of. And I could tell by the people when they're in line waiting for us to open at noon that they have hope. They have hope in their eyes, and it's something that they feel welcome. And it's not just the job seekers who I think have that hope, but I also see the smile on the people's faces of our vendors who are there. And it's an event that they love to participate in, and they come back year after year.
That's great. That's great. Let me ask, since this event's coming up here very soon, is there still an opportunity for people to register to be able to come in?
Yes. You don't have to pre-register for the job fair. It just kind of helps save you time at the check-in process. So you can still pre-register at nwi.com/diversity, but there is no need to pre-register. You just come between 12 and 4 tomorrow.
Okay, well, Roxanne Olejnik is the classified advertising manager for the Times of Northwest Indiana, and she's the coordinator for this now 10th annual Diversity Career Fair and Symposium. It's going to happen on Thursday. It'll be at Avalon Manor, which, of course, is the big banquet center on US 30 in Merrillville. Thank you very much for being with us, Roxanne. Thank you for being with us to talk about this today.
Thank you.
50 years ago, on June 17th, LaPorte High School won the state baseball championship. Well, why is that significant? Well, because 51 years ago, on June 17th, there was no such thing as an Indiana State High School baseball championship. And we have Mike Lopresti, who is a writer for Gannett, the newspapers in Indiana and around the nation as well, too, to talk about this fellow from LaPorte, a guy that people know, in fact, has a field named after him. Mike, thank you for being with us here on Regionally Speaking today.
Sure, glad to be here.
Tell us a little bit about Ken Schreiber has brought to the game of high school baseball and how he got involved and how the game has progressed as well as the state championships from it.
I think what's unusual about his story, you know, we see guys who win a lot of championships in sports, and he certainly has done that. But then you combine that with he is truly a founding father of the state tournament. I think if you go back to baseball in Indiana, high school baseball in the 1960s, you had a handful of programs that were taking it seriously, but there wasn't a lot going on in most programs. They were playing 10 or 15 games a year, or some of those get wiped out by weather. It was sort of like a sidelight. You had nothing such as a state tournament. And then along comes Ken Schreiber, and there were two or three other coaches with him, and they got together and just sort of put the strong arm to the IHSA and said, hey, it's time. It's time for a tournament. You know, they'd had a baseball tournament way back a couple of times in the early part of the 20th century, but it had died a quick death. So they said, hey, it's time to start. Let's put something together. And he was one of the moving forces of it. And then not only at the end on that as one of the organizers, but then his team starts winning a bunch of them. So I think if you put those two together, you've got a giant figure on the landscape of high school baseball in the state.
And for we should mention also, too, that if you're not aware of this, that Ken Schreiber is the only man to coach 7 one-class state high school baseball titles. Nobody else has done that, and nobody else, I guess, from what your article is in the Indianapolis Business Journal, is going to be the case. He's got that record forever.
Well, unless we go back to one class, and I don't see that happening anytime soon or anytime later either. So, any of those records in any sport from the one class days, they're there for good. And he certainly will be there with the 7 championships. It means a great deal to him, as I mentioned in the story. And I think, to have your name there that no one else has done, and you will always be the only person who did that. I think it speaks not only to the program he built, but the passion he built into it and to the ability to get a lot of good players in LaPorte. And you think about it, it's kind of unusual where you find the sort of the mecca of sports in this state. You know, you want to look at basketball and you can go down to the central part of the state in many ways. In baseball, you're talking about two cities, really. You're talking about LaPorte, and you're talking about Jasper. And the enthusiasm and the achievement in those two programs have just stood head and shoulders above just about anywhere else. And certainly Ken Schreiber is a big reason, the LaPorte's part of that.
Now, you mentioned in your article here about the fact that things really got started not only because of Ken Schreiber and LaPorte, but also a couple other men as well, too. You mentioned Spider Fields from Lafayette, Jeff. He's one of these. And another fellow named Jim Reinebold, who is with South Bend Clay High School. Those are these guys that got together and figured we've got to do something better. They took a look at all these other efforts to come up with a state championship structure before that didn't seem to work, and they came up with an idea that did this time.
Yeah, you get this, at least the picture he painted, you get this image of these three guys sitting around a table, maybe having a cup of coffee, you know, plotting this conspiracy. You know, hey, guys, we're going to get together, and we're going to go to the next day, and we're going to make them a deal they can't refuse. Sooner or later, they can't refuse it, and that's what they did. And then they all started winning it. Now, the thing about Nate Ken Schreiber unusual is that he started winning a bunch of them, and a great rivalry back in those days was Lafayette and LaPorte. You know, Lafayette was Spider Fields, and they bumped into one another several times in the state tournament. So you got these three guys in this entire state, you got these three guys getting together and really encouraging and pushing and prodding until the ICSA wouldn't say no. And once it started in 67, it was there to stay.
Now, in your article that people can check out, by the way, going to IBJ.com and going to the sports section to find out more about this, you talk about some of the individual members of some of Ken Schreiber's LaPorte High School baseball teams. Tell us about some of these people and what they're doing these days and how they felt, if they even realized that being on such a historic journey as they were, playing on a team that basically has kind of created the structure of high school baseball.
Well, the guy he talked a lot about was pitcher Al Malakovic, and he was sort of the first star of state baseball tournament in this state. And here's the pitcher, a little guy, I guess, had a great senior year. He went to the state tournament 13-0. I think he had given up like two extra base hits the entire season or something like that. So he starts him in the afternoon game or in the morning game, and LaPorte gets a big lead. I think it was on Columbia City. And, you know, you got the inning limitation. So he takes Malakovic out, you know, with the idea that, hey, he's going to save some innings for him. And so that night, they're playing Indianapolis-Arlington for the championship, and they fall behind 5-0, and he puts Malakovic back in. And so he ends up pitching four innings of shutout baseball. LaPorte comes back and rallies with seven runs, wins 7-5. So Al Malakovic, this little pitcher, wins both games that day and ends up 15-0. Now, he goes on from there. You think, well, you know, a guy like that might have a professional career. It never turned out, and he actually ended up being a custodian for one of the elementary schools in LaPorte. So he's still around there. So it's life, you know, unusual road. But that day, he was the biggest guy in town when he wins two games the same day.
Now, tell us about Ken Schreiber these days now. You mentioned in the article about having a chance to catch up with him here. Tell us what he's doing these days and how he's doing this reminiscing of this very historic event.
Well, it's unusual. I mean, it certainly means a lot to him. He talks about this. I didn't see it, but he talks about this huge scrapbook he has from 1967, which sounds like, you know, it must be like a set of encyclopedias. He has so much things, but what's unusual about him is that he retired, I believe, in 1998. Mm-hmm. He has never been back to a LaPorte game in person. Now, you got to understand, for several years after he retired, he lived across the street from the ballpark. So literally, he would not walk across the street, as the old saying goes, to watch LaPorte play. And the reason he said he did that was he didn't think his presence was going to be any good for whoever followed him. And so he didn't want that to be a factor. Now, I think my guess is there's also a little part of that is he remembers the way it was back in those days. They got, you know, thousands of people to a game. They get radio coverage, road and home. They still get that, by the way. I think he wanted it to remember the way it was.
No.
So he has never been back. Now, he follows it. He follows the radio broadcast, and he was complaining that he couldn't find some of the late scores. They weren't in the paper. So he still follows the program and still remembers 1967 very fondly. In fact, they're having a reunion, I think, later this month. But if you go to a LaPorte baseball game, you will not find Ken Schreiber. You'll find his name on the field. You will not find Ken Schreiber in person.
See, I might just say he's remembering the days that he enjoys the best, the hardest working days that he spent in actually, I guess, getting the team to where it is and how it's been able to make the record books and all. So, man, you can't fault him for that, I suppose.
No. And like I say, he built the program. I think a big thing about this, it had to be for him to win, because not only did he win those seven, he won them over, 25 years. Mm-hmm. So we're not talking about a guy who just happened to have a couple of good classes of kids, because you obviously had a program that was producing champions. And I think what it meant to the Little League system there, to whatever kind of developmental summer league they had or whatever, he talks about how once they won that first one, it sort of got everyone on board and everyone inspired in LaPorte, and the Little League program just exploded into a number of teams. And so you had that self-fulfilling system where you're just turning out players one year after another, and he takes them and goes from there.
Mike LaPresti is a native Hoosier. He is a retired sports writer for the Gannett newspapers in Indiana and elsewhere, and USA Today. You can catch his columns and his stories as well online on IBJ.com. Check out what he has to say. Talking about Ken Schreiber, the famous LaPorte High School baseball coach, who, along with some of his colleagues, created the first and now lasting Indiana High School baseball championship structure. And we thanks very much to Mike for being with us on the program today. A group of East Chicago residents wants a federal court judge to give them a larger role in the cleanup of their lead and arsenic-contaminated neighborhood. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Nick Jansen reports the federal government continues to oppose that intervention.
The East Chicago residents were first turned down in May. A magistrate judge ruled, quote, "This case was closed over 2 years ago. To allow intervention now would be highly prejudicial to the parties." Those parties include the state and federal governments and the companies paying for the cleanup, DuPont and Atlantic Richfield. But the East Chicago residents object to the ruling, and attorney Debbie Chisor, who represents the residents, says a lot has happened in the last 2 years. For example,
the residents only learned the extent of the contamination and the way that their interests were not represented by EPA in the last year.
The Department of Justice this month filed a motion once again opposing the residents' intervention. It argues, quote, "No activity has occurred in this matter since it was closed, and there was, and is, nothing to intervene in." Chisor and the residents are asking a federal district court judge to grant the request. It's unknown when or if that will happen. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Nick Jansen.
In a move that Ports of Indiana CEO Rich Cooper says can be, as he put it, a game changer, California-based Metro Ports will become the new bulk terminal operator at the Port of Indiana Burns Harbor in Portage.
I think they'll impact the supply chains for companies like ArcelorMittal, United States Steel. We can't wait to introduce Mike and his team to those major players in Northwest Indiana.
Cooper predicted to Inside Indiana Business yesterday that the agreement with the 165-year-old company would double the bulk cargo of business at the port within the next 5 years. And he says the operation will be Metroport's first outside of the East, West, and Gulf Coasts.
All those companies use a tremendous amount of bulk raw materials to produce their end product, and they need somebody to handle that and to handle it efficiently.
Cooper compared the deal with FedEx having a hub at Indianapolis International Airport. Metroports has roots that go back to 1852, when the original parent company, which is called the California Stevedore and Ballast Company, was founded during the Gold Rush era. The company will manage the loading and unloading of shipments for port tenants and for outside companies at the port's East Harbor. It'll handle cargoes for the steel, agriculture, construction, energy, and manufacturing industries. It currently operates at 27 ports in some 10 other states. By now, most of us have heard that President Trump wants to kill a $300 million program for the Great Lakes. Other parts of his 2018 budget could also hurt the region. In part three of our series, Elizabeth Miller with the Great Lakes Today reports on a threatened program and research that is based on fish smoothies.
3 months ago, Dr. Chris Winslow became director of Ohio Sea Grant after holding the position on an interim basis. He had big plans for the program, which focuses on science and education. But then the Trump administration released its budget blueprint for 2018, which cut all federal money for Sea Grant programs, including Ohio's.
I had an agenda of things that I was going to be doing over the next 3 or 4 months. That has slightly changed now. There's other things that have to be on there. So it changes, my workload and what I'm addressing.
33 Sea Grant programs around the country are funded by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Every coastal state has one, including the 8 bordering the Great Lakes. The programs have a 3-pronged approach: research, education, and outreach. And Winslow says he wants Ohio Sea Grant to be purposeful in its research.
I contact EPA, I contact the Department of Natural Resources, I contact agriculture, I contact health, and I say, hey, we're going to put another call out for research. You know, what's an issue that you would like to have a better handle on?
For Ohio Sea Grant, the major issue has been harmful algae blooms, the sometimes toxic algae overgrowth that can shut down beaches and threaten drinking water. Ohio Sea Grant has managed over 50 different projects focused on the blooms. They range from tracking blooms and studying water treatment to educating farmers about nutrient runoff. There's also been research on how harmful algae blooms affect people. Research assistant Alex Kwa blends head meat from a walleye, one of Lake Erie's most popular catches. He's on a team helping Ohio create fish consumption advisories based on microcystin, a toxin produced by blue-green algae. This walleye smoothie is the first step in a lengthy process to extract the toxin from the fish. Ohio State University professor Dr. Stuart Ludson leads the research team.
The state's been getting a lot of questions from anglers about whether it's safe to eat fish during the harmful algal bloom season. And so instead of just guessing, they wanted to obviously put some quantitative data to it.
Ludson's team found allowable levels of toxins in the muscle tissue of walleye and yellow perch. He says until further research is done, it's best to follow advisories already set for mercury levels in fish, 1 walleye a week and 2 perch a week. A couple of miles away, Dr. Ji Young Lee studies the effects of microcystin on lettuce, carrots, and green beans by irrigating the vegetables with toxin-contaminated water. Lee says the toxin affects shape and color of the vegetables and a farmer's bottom line.
If the toxin microcystin is there, it definitely affects like a food safety, but also it really affects food quality and crop yield.
Trump's budget blueprint says NOAA programs like Sea Grant primarily benefit industry, state, and local stakeholders. His budget shifts more money to the military and for a wall along the Mexican border. The White House did not respond to a request for further comment, but Winslow says the Ohio Sea Grant program has a broad reach.
Anything we learn about harmful algal blooms, it's going to Florida. It's actually, I would argue, going to Iowa. And Iowa didn't have a Sea Grant program, but Iowa has ag and Iowa has harmful algal blooms.
Ohio's program has survived federal cuts before. It has a diversified revenue stream that includes the university, the state, and private donors. But while NOAA only provides 30% of the Ohio program's total budget, the federal government provides 100% of the research budget, which means some algae bloom studies wouldn't get done quickly or at all. Winslow plans to spend the next few months explaining to Congress how Ohio Sea Grant's research connects to the success of the state's economy and its tourism. For Great Lakes Today, I'm Elizabeth Miller.
Great Lakes Today is a collaboration of public radio stations, WBFO in Buffalo, New York, IdeaStream Cleveland, and WXXI Public Radio in Rochester, New York. And for more stories, you can go to greatlakestoday.org. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Programs that support the arts are under fire in the Trump administration's proposed budget. Counterpoint host Gerard McClendon talked with 4 guests recently about this: Libby Chu with the Indiana Arts Commission, John Kane with the South Shore Arts, Indiana Dunes Tourism CEO Lorelei Weimer, and IU Northwest economist Micah Pollack.
People think about the arts. If it's missing, we feel it. If it's present, we feel it, but sometimes we don't have a deep regard for it. I want to first go around the table and talk about your chief functions at your respective organizations, and then we'll talk about why cutting art can be so detrimental to a community. Libby Chu, let me start with you. What is your chief function at the Indiana Arts Commission?
As a commissioner, we're part of the overseeing board for the function and programming of the Indiana Arts Commission, which is a state arts agency that provides both technical assistance as well as funding to communities in the state of Indiana, not necessarily just arts organizations, but communities that want to have arts in their lives for the citizenry.
Okay, good. We're going to double back and talk about the citizenry later in the segment. Lorelei Weimer from Indiana Dunes Tourism. Mm-hmm. Chief function, what is your chief function? What's the chief function, I should say, of the Indiana Dunes?
Our main objective is to bring visitors to Porter County and get them to extend their stay. So it's we are specialized economic development for our area. So I like to say we put a positive light on our destination and get people excited to come and visit us.
Excellent. And I've got Micah Pollack, the Indiana University professor who's been on Counterpoint before. What is your level of research and what do you teach at Indiana University, Professor Pollack?
Thanks, Jared. I teach economic history. And in that economic history, we focus a lot on Northwest Indiana. So we learn a lot about how Northwest Indiana has changed, which is quite significantly in the last, 50, 60 years or so. And part of my research focuses on the regional economy here in Northwest Indiana and ways that we can improve it.
Okay, so economic history, extending people's tourist stays in Northwest Indiana, and the importance of the arts. I got to get right into this because we have a brand new administration and a new president now. There's been rumors that the NEA, National Endowment for the Arts, and the National Endowment for the Humanities may be witnessing some cuts. And so a person who doesn't really care about the arts might say, doesn't matter, wasted line item, get rid of it anyway. Libby Chu, why are the arts so important to a community?
I want to start with a very basic point that rarely anybody notices, which is the state seal of Indiana. Somebody has to design it. The design itself is an art form. Secondly, if you look at the seal, it shows the agricultural history of Indiana. The woodmen, the bluegrass, there's a bison, and the mountains. Essentially, the native land of Indiana. The whole concept that art is for the elite is placed on that, superimposed on what Indiana is and the country as well.
So it's not just for the elite?
No, it isn't. As I said, you look at a seal that was designed, mm-hmm. art form, mm-hmm. and you look at what's contained in that art form. It's the natural state of Indiana.
Lorelei, getting people to come to Northwest Indiana and to stay in Northwest Indiana and to witness the magnificence of the region, how is art important to that particular manifestation?
Well, one of the things we found through our research is visitors go to a destination and they want to experience things that they can't get in the backyard. Mm. So one of the things we like about art is it's unique. It's different to each artist. So if you're able to incorporate that into your destination, you're giving people a reason to come to see something different that they can't see in their own backyard. We just incorporated art into the visitor center this past summer in celebration of our 30th anniversary. We have these wonderful outdoor murals that magnify the native animals that you'll see in our area. So we recognize how important it is, so much so that we added it to our visitor center.
So you believe that the arts are definitely a factor in tourism?
Absolutely, and definitely a factor in community development. I know the city of Valparaiso has sculptures in the city of Valparaiso, so people are going on the sculpture walk. So it's a critical component in terms of that enhancing that community.
Yeah. Many times we look at things in terms of ones and zeros. It's either on or it's off. It's either making a dollar or it's losing a dollar, or it's breaking even. Professor Micah Pollack, are the arts a factor when it comes to the economy? So often we say, that's those bohemians over there. That's those artsy people who put together stuff that no one really cares about. But is that true? Is there a direct effect on the economy if there's great art being produced and consumed, if there's tourists that will increase to the region because of art? Do we find that there's a factor when art exists economically?
Oh, absolutely. But it's very hard to measure is the challenge. And I can give you one example. Most of us are familiar with here in Northwest Indiana, we have those South Shore posters that you'll see in local businesses and throughout all the community. And those were originally created, and the modern ones are inspired by the Works Progress Administration in the 1930s and 1940s as an effort to get out of the Great Depression as part of the New Deal. And so the legacy of the artwork that was made 80 years ago is still around as part of Northwest Indiana.
Grow most metropolitan product, that's something that you study.
Yes.
Right. And tell us what that means, and then I'm going to tie in art with that.
Okay, yeah. So gross metropolitan product is like GDP or gross domestic product for the nation, but for our local Northwest Indiana region.
Products created.
Yeah, so the value of the economic goods and services produced in Northwest Indiana, and just like GDP at the national level misses a lot of things, our gross metropolitan product, as inclusive as it is, tends to miss a lot of the value of the arts because it's not as tangible as, you know, a can of soda being produced or something like that.
So let's look at it this way.
Yeah.
Let's look at the gross metropolitan product of Northwest Indiana. Let's use the scenario of it increasing over time. Is there a possibility, even though we can't measure what the arts might be giving to the region, if the gross metropolitan product is increasing in Northwest Indiana, might that equal more philanthropic dollars from benefactors, wealthy families, and businesses that may be more willing to give in that climate?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it would affect everything. I mean, if we have an area that has more arts and more nature and more, you know, quality of place, then you attract more businesses, you attract more workers, which then, you know, rolls into more income for the individuals living here, and the cycle just kind of repeats and grows.
Yeah.
I want to throw some numbers in to demonstrate the point.
Yeah.
And it has bearing on the fact that if the National Endowment for the Arts is eliminated, how it can have a negative effect on us. Currently, in this 2017 fiscal year, the contribution of the NEA to the Illinois Arts Commission budget is about 20% for a total of the state budget of $4 million to return to the state of the citizenry. Mm-hmm. Now, from that $4 million, we have a compilation of about $32 million of donated money raised and matched to the grants that we give. Now, and that's not even counting what Micah is talking about, the multiplier effect. You go to a play, the surrounding businesses has an income, and that contributes to the area's economy. So this happens all through the state. Mm. And I think you notice starting at the beginning, I talk about the rural, which is my passion right now, the rural contributions. And yes, we may think that the rural people don't have access to the arts. However, if you talk about the contributor amount to the grants we give there, that's the economic contribution.
That's a good point because, and wow, this segment is going so fast. There's so much I want to cover. I'm glad you brought that up because I think about The Wizard of Oz from time to time. I get a little teary-eyed every time I watch it. I'm beholden to the Judy Garland version of it.
Yes.
You know, when they colorized it.
Yes.
And I actually think I'm there, you know, when I watch that. And aren't there ties to the Wizard of Oz in Valparaiso, Indiana, I believe?
It used to be in Chesterton. They used to have the Wizard of Oz Festival, and they no longer do.
And what was the tie there? Was it because there's a co-writer or something?
No, there actually is really interesting. The lady, her name's June Nelson. I just forgot her first name, but Jean Nelson.
Oh, yes.
It was in the early 80s, and there was an economic downturn in the 80s, and she wanted to just bring some positivity to Chesterton, and she had a little shop called the Wizard of Oz Shop, and so she decided to have the Wizard of Oz Festival, and little did she know that it would grow into this huge festival. And in terms of festivals, it was probably the largest economic return festival that we had in terms of what it brought to the town of Chesterton.
So you got tourism and you got art blended. I got about 2 minutes left in the segment. You look at Gene Shepherd. Mm-hmm. And the ties to the region and Hammond, Indiana, and is that a Christmas story, right? And then you look at the most famous individual in the world, Michael Jackson and the Jackson Five, 2300 Jackson Street, the arts, tourism, economy. You know, it's too bad there's no Jackson 5 Museum here. Mm-hmm. Maybe we can speak that into existence today. Mm-hmm. I want to close this segment, Libby. In 20 seconds, Libby, let's say I'm a multimillionaire. How do you come to me and ask for money for the arts? How would you do that?
First question is, look around you and identify art that you take for granted. The window design. The building you're in, that's architecture.
Yeah.
Your clothing, that is a visual arts design. And now let me talk about the children of the future. We have to build a future.
Yeah.
That's where I would want your money to go, education.
Arts programs everywhere feeling the sting of budget cuts. How can we cut what we love? I've got John Kane joining us, Lorelei Weimer, and Dr. Micah Pollack in the second segment. Thank you so much for sticking around with us. I want to start with John Kane, South Shore Arts and the Northwest Indiana Symphony. John Kane, let's talk about funding. You've been doing this for a few years now. You've been a proponent and a diehard lover of the arts fundraising.
Mm.
Why is it so difficult, John Kane?
Well, I think in one sense, people think of philanthropy and they think of social service, they think of health, they might think of education. I think they think of the arts as something extra beyond that, as maybe not a necessity. When we know that the arts, because it's been proven over and over again, that they can contribute to so many aspects of life, quality of life being one of them, people want to live in a particular place because there are arts there that make it more enjoyable. And economic development is another. The Miller Beach Arts and Creative District in Gary has had enormous success in the last 5 years developing businesses along Lake Street in Miller.
Yeah.
And when that part of Gary was really at a kind of a low ebb, and all of a sudden, because of that arts district, just doing some small little grassroots pop-up art exhibits, they all of a sudden spurred all the 18th Street Brewery coming in, Miller Bakery Cafe reopening, and all kinds of interesting little boutiques and a juice bar, you know, stuff that brings, now that brings people in.
You know, it's funny that you mentioned that because when art is present, you love it. Mm-hmm. When it disappears, you definitely can feel the sphere of influence when it's gone. And mm-hmm. and let's go back to tourism because I had jotted down some notes on my drive. Well, not I didn't jot the notes down on my drive in, but as I was driving in, I was thinking about some things, jotted some notes down. My wife and I went to the Van Gogh exhibit at the Art Institute in Chicago about a year ago. There was a line around the building. It was unbelievable. People from all over the world were there to see that. The Terracotta Warriors were at the Field Museum. When it comes to popular art, it's like everyone gets that, you know, Justin Bieber, Beyonce, okay, I'm going to pay $126 to go to the concert at the United Center. Okay, makes sense. That's for profit. But why is it difficult, and I open this to the three of you, why is it difficult sometimes to collect funds if it's for a not-for-profit endeavor? Why is that difficult? You know, Beyonce at the United Center makes sense, right? She's got the Beehive, huge audience. I'm going to pay my $150, $300 if it's scalped. Sometimes it's hard to get 25 people in an art exhibit if the artist is unknown.
Sure.
So how do we change that? What do we do? We make more people aware? What do we do?
I think it's a combination. I think what we look at it from, you know, what brings people to our area is the Indiana Dunes.
Mm-hmm.
Huge. And a lot of artists come
right.
to be a part of the Indiana Dunes in terms of painting them, photography. But when they get done with their day experience in the dunes and they're looking to extend their stay, that's when they're looking for the Memorial Opera House, the theater at Valparaiso University where there's performing arts. And so we look at the arts as an opportunity to get them to stay longer. Then when they go to the Memorial Opera House or Chicago Street Theater or the 4th Street Theater, they have to eat, right? Then they don't want to go home, so they want to stay in a hotel. So we look at it from an economic impact. It helps that visitor stay longer. And they're looking for, again, they're not always looking for the big Chicago performances. They're looking for the things that are really, truly local. So that's what we look at in terms of that economic impact.
Yeah, yeah. And let's look at economic impact, the locality of business as it pertains to art.
Sure. And I was just going to add, too, that I think one of the challenges is that sometimes it's hard to commodify the arts. Yeah. And those big ticket items you mentioned have been commodified, right? You have to have a building that you go into and there's a line, or you have to pay to get a seat. But most of the art we experience around us is not like that. And I think that's part of the reason it's hard to, you know, put a price tag on it, is because it's more abstract. It's not as tangible. But like the others have said, it has a tremendous economic impact on the region and everything surrounding us.
This is open to the three of you. When budget cuts start to hurt the arts, who should care?
Well, everybody should
care. Everyone should care.
Everyone.
Explain. Explain, John.
Well, because it does affect your quality of life, or it might affect your child's education. We started what we call the Every Kid program at South Shore Arts back in 1995, and it was just for little kids from Hammond, fourth graders, to come to the Arts Center in Munster after school for art classes. There was this young boy who was 8 or 9 years old back then, named Diego Gonzalez, and he went to Irving Elementary. And he would walk. It was the dead of winter. He would walk all the way after school to Munster because he didn't have a parent who could drive him there, because it meant so much to him for him to have that opportunity to take art classes. And a couple of years ago, when it happened to be the 20th anniversary of the Every Kid program, I got an email from this Diego Gonzalez. Who's that? He said he'd been watching me for a while. And I thought, well, who are you? And he is such a positive outcome for me to talk about. He's gone on to have a big career as a body painter and airbrush artist, and he works throughout the country, New York, L.A., doing fashion shoots and music videos, and he's just a little kid. He was a little kid from Hammond, Indiana.
Yeah, yeah. So everyone should care, and everyone is affected by those cuts.
Whether you believe it or not, too, because even if you don't care about the arts, a healthy economy and a growing economy requires a strong arts base. Mm-hmm. And so even if you want a job, you have to have a strong economy, and to have a strong economy, you have to have quality of place, and that's where the arts fit in.
Yeah. You know, think about traveling. And whenever you go on a long trip, it doesn't matter. If you're in your car after a hard day's work, the first thing you revert to is some sort of art. You get in the car and it's like it's an involuntary function. You turn on that radio, or you go to SiriusXM satellite, or you go to your favorite musical station or talk radio station to consume some sort of art, be it rhetoric, talk radio, or be it news, which is still a production, an art form, NATAS, the National Arts Television Arts Society. And no matter who you are, you could be the most technically minded scientist, but it's just something about that art. You know, why do we like nice interiors in cars, as Libby mentioned earlier? Art. Why do we love looking at beautiful buildings, homes, skyscrapers? Art. So we're consuming it constantly. And so when budget cuts come down from a federal level or from a local level, is it time to become activists at that point, or do we just kind of lay in the cut, be silent, and just continue to just quietly call the people who we think are going to give to the arts programs?
Well, there are obviously some people who are more vocal about it than others.
Like and, John Cain.
Well, oh, yes, I'm just such a mouthpiece for it. But, you know, you mentioned great art in places, the art and then the big blockbuster exhibits. But those we go to other countries because of their art.
Yeah.
And empires produce that art. Governments produce that art. And we don't go to Rome or any place in Italy because they have a great military. They haven't had a great military since the fall of Rome. France, Napoleon. You know, that's the most recent. But honestly, we go there for the art.
Yeah.
And that was government-supported art. And the blockbuster that you saw in Chicago, that where it was wrapped around the building, the Van Gogh, the first blockbuster was the King Tut.
Yes.
Back in the 70s. Oh, my God. I love that so much.
Oh, I was there.
I was, too.
Oh.
8 million people in this country saw that. And that was the first blockbuster, and it generated so much income for the cities that hosted it. And that had some government backing. And it also helped with diplomacy. Yeah. Because there was such a problem between the United States and Egypt at that time.
So, can I get Libby Chu, can I get John Cain, Michael Pollack, and Lorelei Wymer to come up with a business, let me get it right, a business tourism and arts strategy to bring everyone to Northwest Indiana to consume art in Porter County and in Lake County? We'll bring Spiro in as well to look at our art. They have to come through here because we're at the crossroads, right? We've got the Borman Expressway. Hundreds of thousands of people travel down that thing every day. How do we get them off the road to Munster, South Shore, to see symphony, to see art? How do we get them off the road to the Lake County Convention and Visitors Bureau, to Indiana Dunes? How do we get them off the road to consume our art? They have to come through here. How do we get them to exit?
So from what we do is that's what our job is we do the marketing. And we make sure that they understand what we have available. So we have it on our website. We have it in our publications. We do have sections specifically on our art. So that's part of it, is just the overall awareness. One of the things, there is a tourism analogy to this whole thing. The state of Michigan, you know, we're in the height of the recession. The state of Michigan's not doing so well economically. And yet their legislature gave them $30 million to promote tourism. Why? Because they saw it not as an expense, but as an investment in their state, and it's paid off significantly with Pure Michigan. That's what they need to start looking at in terms of the arts. It is truly not an expense. It's an investment into children's lives. It's an investment into our communities. And when we start to shift our thinking in terms of this, I think you're going to see the difference. But if we think it's an expense that can be cut from a budget, that's going to happen. But if we look at it as an investment, I think that's where you'll see the money coming forward.
It's the one thing I think that, well, of course, Chicago, but it's the one thing that I think that Northwest Indiana has a lot of other communities beat on, is great art. John Cain, Libby Chu, they're getting that message out. The visitors' bureaus, you'd pull over, maybe just to get a drink of water and to rest for a moment, but you can see art in those visitors' bureaus. So I'm wondering, in this last minute or so that we have, is there a way to put this into hyperspace where we say, Northwest Indiana, let's put it all together and show the world that this is the place for high art? 15 seconds, John Cain. How do we do that?
I think it's a great, I like your challenge for us, and I think it's a great idea. It's something we could work on.
Yeah.
The most recent Quality of Life Indicators report from one region suggested that our region needs a strategic cultural plan.
Yeah, and if we have a strategic cultural plan, Michael Pollack, we're going to increase our, what is it again?
Gross metropolitan product.
That can happen.
We'll have more people moving here, more people visiting here. They'll spend their money here, and that'll help all businesses, whether you appreciate the arts or not.
Yeah. And the more people we can get off that expressway, Lorelei.
That's more money, new money we're importing into our communities.
Counterpoint with Gerard McClendon airs Friday nights at 8 o'clock on Lakeshore PBS, and it's rebroadcast on Sunday mornings at 10. Having a parent behind bars can adversely impact a child's behavioral, emotional, and even physical health. And Indiana has some of the highest incarceration rates in the country. Indiana Public Broadcasting and Side Effects Public Media's reporter Jill Sheridan tells us about one research project that aims to identify how children are affected and possible solutions to this social determinant.
A social determinant of health, a condition or circumstance that plays into how a person is born, grows, lives, and ages.
I've noticed a change in my son, me not being there, because of being incarcerated.
Terrell Harris's son was young when Harris spent 2 years in prison on a drug charge. Now Harris is part of a research project that aims to identify how incarceration impacts family health.
I mean, it kind of puts them in a stressful situation because they're wishing their dad was here. Also, it takes away from that structure that they're normally used to on a normal day-to-day basis.
And it can be more than mental health problems. Some studies point to long-term physical health issues like heart problems and asthma, but the research is limited. This project aims to add data. Volunteers will go into communities to talk to people who have been impacted by the incarceration of a loved one and ask questions about how that has impacted the family's health.
There has to be a lot
About 75 volunteers attended a summit last month held by the Indianapolis Congressional Action Network, or IndyCan, a nonprofit group helping to organize the research. More than 1 in 10 Indiana youth have a parent who has been incarcerated, the second highest rate in the nation.
But the hard part is, like, that plan.
IndyCan Executive Director Shoshana Spector led a session. She says incarceration should be a last resort, not a first response.
No child should be afraid that they'll never see their parents, even if it's just 6 weeks or 6 months, when there's plenty of alternatives.
Alternatives such as treatment and diversion strategies like crisis intervention. Spector says if communities don't commit to reducing the number of people being incarcerated, the cycle will just continue.
We are traumatizing people for generations.
The U.S. leads the world with incarceration rates, and Indiana has a 7% higher rate than the national average. Director of Riley Childhood Development Center, Angela Tomlin, says the social determinant of having a parent incarcerated can be a child's first strike.
So you think about it, everything is related all the way back to those early relationships and safe environments.
Tomlin is the research project psychologist.
Stress over time can build up, and what we've been finding through many different studies is that these effects of stress can persist into adulthood.
Black teens in Indiana are twice as likely to have a parent in jail as whites. Some evidence points to the relationship of mass incarceration and racial health inequity. This is the sort of data that the IndyCan project hopes to build on. Project volunteer Terrell Harris's wife served 10 years. She went to prison when her son was 2 and got out when he was 13.
So now imagine a son that you've never seen all these years and get out and trying to be a mother to that child. You know how much resentment that child has against you because you were gone?
Harris says that resentment and stress has led to health problems.
And now he's suffered from PTSD, ADHD, you know, because, you know, he's been in these messed up situations. And now he thinks that's the cool. Now, because he has to live up to a status quo that his parents were incarcerated.
The group hopes to present their findings to the Indiana legislature next year.
For Indiana Public Broadcasting and Side Effects Public Media, I'm Jill Sheridan.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking. For today, I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. Coming up tomorrow, it's, of course, Thursday. It'll be Reporters Roundtable Day of the big Northwest Indiana stories. And the reporters with us will include John Gard talking about the LaPorte County Fairgrounds, Dan Carton, and the 42 tax hikes that take effect on July 1st, and Joseph Pete will have a regional business report for us as well coming up on tomorrow's program.